Bonnie Hughes is a midwife with a background in musical theatre and journalism. She is the creator of the podcast series Making a Midwife and an animation filmmaker hobbyist. Bonnie is passionate about the power of story and how the stories we tell ourselves, the stories we live, the stories we are part of, and the characters we play in those stories shape the future. Bonnie explores both through her midwifery work and her art how she can create a positive and uplifting impact for both midwives and the women and families in her care. This episode will fuel your day tenfold when you hear us talking with Bonnie about the importance of taking up space and the power of anger. A gem of an episode that can't be missed, whether you're a midwife or not. We discuss working as a newly qualified midwife, her incredible stop animation film titled Big Trouble, how society puts girls and women into a place where they have to earn their worth, how women are conditioned to be small in size and mind, and the constant worry about how much space we take up in the world. We touch on how almost every woman in a maternity unit talks about their size, whether pregnant or not. We discuss how anger destroys us when we silence ourselves and let it fester. And we ask, how can we use anger for its best purpose? So you know the drill. Tie up your shoelaces, put the dog on the leash, or pop that kettle on. Because you are in for a treat with this episode of The Midwife's Cauldron. I'm Katie James, and this is the Midwives Cauldron podcast. Each episode, I'm joined by my incredible co-host, Dr. Rachel Reed. Listen in as we hubble, bubble, toil and trouble our way through aspects of womanhood, midwifery, birth and lactation. So go on, subscribe now, and hear us on your favourite podcast host. But just a sec, before we start on this epic episode, if you love the show and want more from Rachel and me, then head on over to our websites and check out all the courses, books, collectives a go-go. You'll find all the details and occasional discount deals on the old Instagram at The Midwife's Cauldron, or, of course, in the show notes below. And if you really, really love the show, please consider two things: a single or a monthly donation over on Patreon, or even buy me a coffee. And remember, that review you leave on your podcast host really makes a difference in who listens in. Thank you for your support. We just love having you bubbling away with us. Bonnie Hughes, welcome to the Cauldron. It is a delight. Pleasure to have you with us today. Thank you so much.
Oh, pleasure is all mine, believe
Bonnie,
me.
For our audience, it would be lovely if you could just tell us a little bit about how you got into midwifery and where you are now with your midwifery.
So I got into midwifery because I got pregnant and I never, ever, ever, ever had that maternal desire to have kids. I just, you know, those people that say, oh, I always just wanted to be a mum, that was never part of who I was. And then I met this very lovely, wonderful man who's now my husband, Lee, and we talked about whether or not we wanted kids and sort of put it on the back burner. And then we got married and we were living in the UK, and because he's from the UK, and we had another sort of conversation, right? Do we want to sort of try for kids? Because I was getting older. And I sort of thought maybe you don't need to have a, like, maybe I should consider it. I've never really considered it. And so I considered it for 2 weeks and then went, no, actually, I really don't want to be a parent. And so we're like, okay, well, we're not going to try for kids then. But in that 2 weeks, I got pregnant. And so then I actually found it really hard because I didn't want to be a parent. And I was now in this world of, well, you're going to be. And I really hated it. And I was scared. I was so scared of having kids. And I went through lots of different midwives where I was in the UK. I was in Birmingham, and I think it was just one of those sort of, you know, unlucky sort of wrong time things where I had one midwife and she went on mat leave, and then I had another midwife and she moved to another place, and then I had another midwife. And I think what I learned from that was how much midwifery, the midwife you have, makes a difference to how you feel about your entire pregnancy and being a parent and being a mother. And, you know, a good visit can make you feel like you're okay and you got this and you can do it, and a bad visit can make you panic and not know where to put your foot next. And I had lots of mental health issues in that pregnancy, I think, because I was so scared and because I didn't, you know, I just wasn't feeling like I wanted to be a parent. And eventually halfway through, it's probably about when I was about 33 weeks, we moved back to Australia. Ooh. And I met my midwife, Lorraine, who I went through the rest of my pregnancy with. And she was wonderful and she was just amazing. And she sort of just changed my whole experience. And I had Everest, my first, and the experience of the birth was just like life-changing. It was amazing. I loved it. It was my favorite part of the whole pregnancy. Mm. And it's not that it wasn't hard, just that it was awesome. And then after that, I was like, this is what I want to do. I want to be a midwife. And it just sort of hit me. Mm. And so I ended up having another baby. I had another one during COVID. And I was studying while I had her, and that was a whole sort of other barrel of laughs in itself. But yeah, that's sort of how I fell into it, by sort of noticing how midwifery care can really change someone's whole experience and journey into parenting, and then having finally that really good support from someone. And Lorraine was this midwife where she'd walk in the room and she'd do whatever she did, and by the time she left, the woman in the room would feel more confident in herself. She would have had a little bit of a laugh. She would have felt seen and heard and cared for, and everything would have changed. And she might have only been in the room for 30 seconds, but she just, I don't know what she did. She was just magnificent. Yeah.
That's lush. And so now here you are as a newly qualified midwife. When did you qualify, Bonnie?
I qualified April 2021, I think. Yeah, something like that. I've been out almost 2 years.
So did your studies get shifted because of COVID, or did you qualify on time?
They did. They got set back about 6 months, but that partly was due to COVID and partly due to my university not being great. I think our university had a bit of a crisis during that time, and later found out that they were potentially going to shut down the direct entry midwifery course, which seems like a recurring story, and we weren't told. And so we didn't get given placements for ages. And I ended up going through the ombudsman of the state that this university was in to get them to get the uni to get us placements. And it was a real battle. So it probably was put back about 6 months, but in a way, with having a baby as well during that time, it was probably, in a way, I couldn't have done it any quicker because there's so many placements. And that was the hardest thing, was being away from a baby and the guilt of that. To go and do placements is like out of this world.
So this was a direct entry bachelor midwifery?
Yeah, so I've not done nursing. I've studied musical theatre. That's not...
We haven't done nursing either.
No. Well, I think, and it drives me balmy when people call midwife nurses because it's so different anyway. So now I've been out for almost 2 years and I work in a smaller, like not a tertiary hospital in WA, and I love midwifery and I love the times that we get to do midwifery. And I find a lot of the rest of it pretty, it's just a battle. You fight a lot with yourself and with silly policies and things that shouldn't be happening. But when you get to do real midwifery and woman-centered care, it's epic. It's really epic. Yeah.
Bonnie, what can you talk about? Because you're so fresh out, it's really interesting to just have a look at how you...
Sorry, there's a guinea fowl disaster.
A guinea fowl disaster.
A what? A guinea fowl?
It's a type of bird.
What's a guinea? I don't even know what a guinea fowl is. I'm going to Google
They
it.
Make the tiny little speckled eggs.
Oh, cute. They are spotty.
Sorry.
Is it alive still, Rachel?
Yeah, no, I think there was a fight with a chicken.
Oh, dear.
Everybody's fine. It's deafening guinea fowl noise. Look it up if anybody's listening and doesn't know what that sounds like.
Marvellous. I might start the question again.
Okay, I'm back. Sorry.
Bonnie, you are, as you're really newly into midwifery and qualified, what I wanted you to just talk to us a little bit about was just some of those differences you found from being a student midwife to then jumping into being the like fully qualified, here you go, off you go, you've got your qualifications, go do your job.
We'll be right back.
I just wanted to pop into your luggles and tell you about my brand spanking new podcast, The Feeding Couch. This podcast ain't just designed with pregnant women or new parents in mind, but also for all of us working in the space of birth work. This is the podcast where I hand the mic over to a different mom, dad, parent, or even grandparent to take us on their feeding journey. Every story matters. It's often through hearing others' experiences where we find our own inner knowledge, strength, and courage. Listen in to hear the stories told of triumph, challenge, heartwarming, tear-jerking, fist-pumping, and how we each deal with our venture into this new world emotionally, socially, and physically. Whether you're a student, a newbie midwife, doula, lactation exam prepper, or just hungry for more knowledge, these stories will also give you a backstage pass to the global lactation clinic. Whether you're pregnant and seeking information or supporting those on their journey, I can't wait to see you on the couch with me soon. Oh, and a little favour, your reviews on Apple Podcasts mean the world. They're like magic beans that help spread the podcast out for those who need to hear it. Let's make this something amazing together.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, I think the main one obviously is that responsibility, because as a student, you've got that little bit of protection where even if something goes wrong, you do the wrong thing, really, the ownership is on the midwife that is precepting you. Mm. And so there is that sort of protection and the mental load, I think, as well. It's not less, I don't think, because I think as a student there's so much that's running through your head that you want to remember and you want to be helpful and you don't want to be useless and you don't want to get in anyone's way and you just want to help because probably you're going to work with these people one day and you've got to make a good impression. And I think that's one of those things as a student, you can't be yourself because you just have to be somebody that people want to work with later. And then you get into the workplace and I think in one way there's this ease, or it's not easier. In one way, there's a bit of a release because you can have a sick day, which you can't as a student. Well, not when the uni I went through, they didn't account for anyone ever having a sick day. And you can have a cry, you can, you know, sort of, when you're an employee, you can be more of a whole person, I think. But then again, you've got so much responsibility. And I've now seeing, like, it probably took me about 6 months into the degree. I think I would message you, Katie, and be like, I'm just sitting in my car trying to get myself to walk into work. And it probably took me a good 6 months before I wasn't scared of walking into work, because I was so scared of not knowing what I was going to be faced with that day, what load I was going to be given, because it doesn't matter whether you've been there for 10 years or 1 month. Yeah. The load will be what you get. It'll just, you'll get given what you're given. And usually as a new grad, you know, if you're starting out in your labour ward rotation, you will be given the primip who's had an induction for a stupid reason and has been told to have an epidural before they had Cinto. And so you're going to have a very long day in a room with a lot of things that you need to do that you probably don't agree with. And it's just draining. It's exhausting. And at my work, we do 12-hour shifts, which in a way for me is good because it means I'm away from the kids less. But, God, they're long. They're really long. So, yeah, and I think it's tricky because as a student, you're obviously, you're presented with a lot of new research all the time and you're always looking up, you know, what's coming out about this and what's the information say about this. But once you get into it, that sort of falls away and you don't have to do that, which I think is poor, because it seems that midwifery is this area that hasn't had a lot of research compared to other areas, but is getting lots of research now. But we're not looking at it. And so, because I think a question that I ask myself a lot is, why is there research saying X, Y, Z, but there's no change? And I'm really trying to figure out the correct answer to that question. I think it's very multifactorial, but I think that's one of the things as a student, you're really encouraged to read the research and to know what things are about. But then when you come in as a student, it's not often that you're listened to about those sorts of things. And then you come in as a grad and you don't even have time to get those words out of your mouth and no one will sort of back you up anyway. So,
well, it's I think there's a simple answer as to why it's not evidence-based, because it never has been and it never will be. It's a culture-based practice. And, you know, interventions were introduced without any research, and then even with good research showing that they're not helpful, in fact, they're harmful, they stay as a cultural norm because they fit the needs of the institution. So you're not going to get a change. It doesn't matter how much excellent research you put out there. The system won't embrace that research unless it fits what it wants it to. You know, we saw that with the ARRIVE trial. Mm-hmm. One trial out of all of the other trials that showed an increase in cesarean section with induction, one trial didn't, and, you know, we could go into, will not, because there's, Google it, because there's lots of people who've done kind of critiques of it, and I think I have on my, it's not a great piece of research to say that, and yet that's a bit of research that's grasped onto by the system to continue to support induction. They ignore all of the other research. So I think once we understand it, that it doesn't matter how much research we have, the practices are not going to change, because it's cultural, then we can start to understand we can kind of relax a little bit. There's no point in fighting about from that perspective. But as midwives, we do need to be informing women of the research, because that's part of getting consent. Because, you know, the policies can say to do anything, but you can't do those things unless you've got consent. So I think, you know, midwives are so exhausted, overworked, and just want to get on with the practice. I was there. I never wanted to look at another piece of research ever again when I qualified. Done. But part of the professional responsibility is that updating and giving adequate information for consent. And if you can't rely on the organisation you're working for to give you that information, you're kind of going to have to go and find it so you can share it with women.
And I think, I mean, the more I look at it all, the more I think this is actually maternity care feels like a symptom of a bigger problem, which is that women are not, we're not taught that we're powerful, that the fact that we can grow life in our bodies is super like mysterious and epic and like indescribable. Mm-hmm. And we're not told to listen to our bodies and to learn about our bodies and to have intuition into what is my body saying? Is this a full body yes, or is this something feeling uneasy? And we're not taught to trust ourselves. In fact, we're taught completely the opposite. And, you know, the fact that in health, in maternity care, the onus is on the staff, the healthcare staff, it shouldn't be. The onus should be on the woman, us trusting her that she knows her body, that she knows her baby, that she'll tell us if there's something wrong. And the only way that you can avoid someone getting an induction that they shouldn't be getting or whatever is if she says no. That's the only thing. And so you're absolutely right. The key seems to be educate women, build up women, empower women to know their bodies and to know their rights and to know what things actually entail, and then maybe you'll see maybe not a shift in practice but an increase in people declining these things, which they shouldn't have to do anyway, but anyway.
And that needs to start with girls, doesn't it? We kind of, it's right, it's from, you know, you're right, the maternity system is a symptom. It's one small little part of a woman's life, but we start socializing girls early on to not listen to their bodies, you know, to not listen to that gut instinct that that person's not a good person. Instead, be nice, go and say hello to that person, go and sit on their knee. You know, like we overrule little girls continually about their instincts. And then obviously when they, you know, start menstruating again, it's that, okay, what you do is you take a pill to get rid of the pain. It's helping, you know, we don't celebrate their body and teach little girls how to connect with their body and trust and to believe in themselves. If you feel something's not right for you, it's not right for you.
Yeah.
We take away all the creativity.
Yeah.
Children are born with creativity to express themselves in nature, in their clothing, in whatever. And we put them in these boxes of conformity, or we have done for so long. And that takes the spark. It takes the genuineness. It takes the listening to what I want to do. All of this in every single facet, particularly with girls, we muffle them and stop them showing themselves. And so then how are you supposed to trust what's being said?
And we punish girls for speaking out. You know,
I
was constantly told I was bossy. That was me as a kid. I was a bossy kid. I don't think I would have been called a bossy kid if I'd been a boy. I was bossy, to be fair. But that attribute was not something, that was something I was supposed to repress and stop bossing people around and stop speaking up and stop saying those nasty things to people. You know, stop calling things out because you're meant to be nice. Don't point them out. You know, we do that. And then we expect women to step up when they're pregnant saying, I'm not going to do that because it feels wrong, and say that to authority.
Yeah, you would have been you would have been called a leader if you were a boy.
And yeah. Oh, he's going to be prime minister one day.
Yeah. And then you know, like I think, and as a girl, if you don't earn purpose by being beautiful, then you have to be clever, or you have to be funny, or a really hard worker, and. Mm. Do you know, I think all of that, it's all just a distraction from listening to ourselves. Like all of it is just taking away from us actually going, but who am I? And I'm actually allowed to be whoever I am, and I don't actually have to earn my place in this world by being funny or being pretty or being clever or being the hardest worker. You know, like I think productivity is such a big thing. We're all told we have to be doing stuff all the time, and like it feels good to do something. It feels really good to do something and have people acknowledge it and have people say, wow, you must have worked really hard on that. That feels good. But I don't think we've understood that that's not everything all the time, because it's not sustainable. And then we get sick, but we keep going because God, we've got to earn our place and be worthwhile in the world by being busy.
Which brings us on to not the only reason, but one of the reasons that Katie and I, and we've got to get Bonnie onto the podcast. So you were asked to create an animation for the Strength to Progress conference that was in WA last month or the month before. And so this conference was, you know, obviously about strength to progress, and it was unintentionally, I probably shouldn't say that because Claire would like it to sound like it was intentional, but it was amazing because all the speakers, it looked like they'd got together and kind of woven these kind of threads through. And then at the end, we watched your animation and it was just like, I cried, Katie. And
I sat in my kitchen in the evening. Bonnie had then sent it to me afterwards. She told me you'd cried, which was then I was like, oh my God, I need to get tissues ready to watch this. And then I was so glad no one was in the house. I was bawling. Well, I mean, it doesn't take much for me. So I was on the next level of falling.
I think I was sitting behind you when you watched it, because I've got this dizziness thing and I have to sit on the ground and look at things at a certain angle. And I saw you wipe your face and I thought, oh no, she's got something in her eye.
Rachel Reed crying.
It was amazing. So I'd love for you to tell us a bit about how did you do that? Like,
well, I whinged a lot to Lee about how I had no idea what to do and how I'm not a filmmaker and I don't know what I'm doing and why would anyone trust me to do this because I've got no clue. So I did a lot of that. So God bless Lee for listening to that. And I think because we had been back and forth, so I'd been back and forth so many times with Claire and Kira because I've been really sick and I've been too scared to do anything that has put any extra pressure on my system mentally or emotionally or physically. And so I was saying, no, I'm not, I can't do it. I'm not well enough. And then eventually I was like, Bonnie, just put your big girl knickers on and do it. And Claire said, I gave Claire a bunch of ideas about things I could go on rants about. And she said, or do one about female anger. And I thought, well, I've pretty much been angry since I became a student midwife, so I can probably talk about that a fair bit. And then I think because I only had about 4 weeks, I think it was 4 or 5 weeks, and I just had to sit down and write the script. And I ended up just sitting there and thinking about this time that those women had told me that I was getting too big. And I don't actually think at the time that it had upset me at all. But thinking about it as an adult and imagining if someone said that about my daughter, and I was like, how are we so conditioned to think women should be small that you would say that about a 10-year-old girl who's just, you know, doing something she loves, something creative, something artistic, and you'd say that her weight was an issue. Like, and I think my whole entire life I've been a heavier set person. That's probably just how my body copes. And, you know, I think we have certain griefs and traumas in our life, and our body might cushion us and cushion our grief and cushion our emotions maybe with extra presence and extra material and extra stuff on our bodies. I don't know if that's true, but it's something I've thought about. And I was thinking, God, imagine if we stopped worrying about how big we are and how much space we take up. It's so silly, isn't it? How much space we take up in the world, and we're obsessed with it. We're completely obsessed. You don't see a woman come in to have her baby without her having some mention of how big she's gotten, or, you know, how how she's hopeful that she'll be able to get fit again and lose that weight after she has her baby. And you just, and all the midwives at work, God bless them. I love them so dearly, but I can't hear anyone else tell me they're going on a diet before Christmas, or they can't go on a boat because their tummy's too big. Or, I mean, you're just worth so much more than how big your knickers are. Like, it just doesn't matter. And I just, you know, and there's health is a different thing, and, you know, there's working through stuff in your life, and maybe that releases some material from your body, maybe it doesn't, I don't know. But I'm just so tired of people, of women constantly thinking that they have to be small to be able to exist in this world. And I have thought like that for years and years and years. I absolutely have. And I have deprived my body, and I have worked it too hard, and it's not improved my life in any way, shape or form. And I was writing this thing about anger, and I realized I was really angry about that. And I just, it just sort of went from there. And it was so interesting, actually, hearing, like, learning about anger and learning about all the health things that come up for women when they don't express their anger. And Soraya Chemerly, if anyone hasn't read her book, Rage Becomes Her, it's brilliant and you should read it. And she just writes so eloquently about all the different aspects of women's anger and how sick women get. And it's the rates of illness and that derive from unprocessed anger, anger that just sits there and festers and festers and festers. Like, it's huge. It's huge. And it's like a public female health crisis, but we don't talk about it because we're doing the right thing by not getting angry. And, like, outwardly. And that's the other thing. We are angry. Feminine rage is a real thing, and we're all angry. We're just not expressing it. So instead of actually getting angry about it outwardly, we're just holding it in and making ourselves sick. And I think I've known examples of women in my life who probably should have been angry about things and weren't. And I don't know what would have happened if they were openly angry about certain things in their lives, but I can't imagine that it would have been a bad thing for them to express that anger. But except for the fact that they wouldn't have been in safe situations to express it. Anyway, I'm going on a tangent. Yeah. So, and I did a short film for a student like a ACM conference a couple of years ago, and I did this stop motion thing. And I'm not a filmmaker; I don't really know what I'm doing, but it was super fun, and I quite enjoy small mini dolls. I really enjoy them, and so I got to make this little film for the Student Midwife Conference and use the podcast interviews that I'd done, which was awesome because I didn't have to say anything super cool or important in the film. It was just came from the mouths of other people like you, Katie. And I thought, yeah, this is fun. I can do this again. And it just ended up working really well. And I don't know about, I think when I write these scripts and things, I think I'm very lucky. I don't actually think it's me. I think there's some sort of storyteller ancestor that I must have in my life that writes these things, and they just work out well. I feel like I can't really take ownership of it. Or maybe I should. I'm not sure.
Well, yeah, I was going to say it's interesting, isn't it? You need to own that.
I know
what you mean. When I write, the creative process often, I don't know how I ended up writing the things I write, but it is me and it is you. And we may be, you know, being sustained and helped by other aspects or elements of whatever, but ultimately that's yours.
Maybe it's just that fact that maybe it's just shutting out all the inner critics that go, don't write that, that's stupid. Don't say that, it's really dumb. Don't do that, it's going to be stupid. And just going, shh, I'm just doing it. I think that's what you do. You just
and that's the true Bonnie.
Yeah.
That's the true inner us that we're actually able to finally listen to, the little girl who was silenced. and has all those voices is actually going, I am creative. I am strong.
Yeah.
I will write this because it needs to be heard. And then when it's out there, we have to put those masks back on to a certain extent to go, am I allowed to be this way? When actually you are a filmmaker, Bonnie, in my eyes. Mm-hmm. You made two incredible films that are, not only are they incredible for literal filmmaking, they're incredible because the messages that go out are delivered in such a way that they just like stab you in the heart and the tear ducts. And it's not just about making people cry, but they make you think. And what they did and what the second film did is it made me angry and then gave me hope. And that's what you led us to with this film, because, and I think I should hand over to you because I want you to describe that process of where we should be taking our anger and how we can bring this into midwifery.
It's a good question, and I think I'm still working it out. And I think a lot of it might be to do with compassion. And because I think sometimes we get angry about things and we see red and we maybe don't, I don't know if it's about stopping and like doing a body scan and going, hang on, what's actually going on here? Because I'm really angry about this. Do I have a boundary that's been crossed? Do I have a need that's not been met? Or am I watching this happen to someone else? Because I think that as midwives, that's what we see a lot. And then I think sometimes, you know, as a midwife, if a choice is made about a woman, it does cross our boundaries because we're the ones that are going to have to deliver that care that we don't think is the best. And I think we don't show ourselves enough compassion because in a way, if you're a midwife working in a hospital, you've got to do the plan that the woman consents to. And we can give her as much information as we can and to try and make sure that consent is informed. But in reality, the fact is that she probably hasn't, it's not informed consent because she's probably not going to have been given, you know, weeks to go and research that information and really understand the consequences that might go on into 4, 5, 6 years postpartum / her whole mothering journey. And so I think we all need to show ourselves a lot of compassion. And I think we need to look at the people that are making those choices as well. And this is the really hard part, and go, where is their choice coming from that's made me angry? Like someone, there's this sort of thing that happens a lot that I see a lot where a doctor might come in he's looking at a CTG trace and it's average. It's not great. It's not bad. It's somewhere in the middle. And they might come in and say to the woman, I think we need to help baby out. Do you know what I mean by that? And the woman who's exhausted and not really with it and over it and all that stuff might say, yes, that's fine. She's no concept of what that means, putting a vacuum on or forceps or whatever it is. And that's a situation where I get really angry immediately at whoever's walked in and just said that. But I don't think that we win this sort of fight with immediate rage. I think the first thing has to be compassion. Compassion for myself, compassion for that woman, and even compassion for that doctor, because I don't know what that doctor is coming from and I don't know what he's seen. I don't know what he's been told and I don't know where he's come from. But there's got to be a reason. that this is happening right now. And that's really hard to see things from their perspective because it's not natural for me. And I feel like I know the full story and they don't. But regardless of that, and I don't even know if that's right. It's just something that I'm thinking about. I think compassion is a really big thing. And I think compassion in a way sometimes helps you look at that big anger that you've got without fear and without that sting and that tightness in your throat, and helps you actually just breathe a little bit. And then it is breaking it. I mean, so our hospital has had some big changes, or is going through some big changes, because one of the senior midwives, so our hospital used to have 5 midwifery group programs and used to have the highest rate of vaginal births and water births in WA, and it was just a fantastic unit to work in. And it's now down to 1.5 MGP teams and really, you know, rates that are really faltering. And one of the midwives got angry, really angry the other day. And this anger has been building in her for years and years and years. And she took that one step and she sent an email around to everyone and said, I can't do this anymore. We need change. I don't know if anybody's feeling the same way, but this is what I'm upset about. She wrote a bunch of things. Wow. And then another person emailed back and said, yeah, I agree. I can't do it anymore. I'm angry about that too. I'm angry about these things as well. And then another person and another person and another person and another person. And everyone was included in the emails, everyone. The casual midwives, the MGP midwives, the management, everyone. And so I emailed her, the first midwife, and I said, so what do we do? Because I don't know. I've not been in the hospital system that long and I don't know how to fix things, but I don't know. I didn't want to do nothing, because sometimes I feel like just whinging about it doesn't do anything, although it does. It gets people sort of thinking. Anyway, she said, well, we need to set up a meeting. We need to tell people X, Y, Z. We need to do this and do that. And so from that came, so last, a few couple of weeks ago, we had a meeting with one of the executive directors, and we'd said to them, you know, the midwifery morale is really falling. They'd read all the emails that had gone round, and they had put out like 9 chairs. We'd said some of the midwives are going to come and we're going to talk to you about what's happening. Well, we had so many midwives rock up. We had like, I don't know, there were 40 or 50 in the room. There was heaps of them online. Everybody that was working in the core staff on the ward was watching online, because they put it as like a Teams link thing, and it was amazing. And the executive director was like shocked that there was that many people that had come. And I was the spokesperson for the midwives that day, and it was epic. Like, it was really amazing, because this woman, who's actually been very good, sat and listened to our concerns. So we all got together and tried to write down a list of our main concerns, which ranged from the fact that we've not been managed well and the staff conditions are really poor, to the fact that there's really poor, poor consent gained by the doctors, and that staff are leaving because they can't watch this sort of trauma anymore. And if you think about it, So we're now in the process of negotiating lots of different things with our management, and who knows what's going to come of it. I don't actually know. There might be big changes. We've already seen some changes, or there might be average changes. I'm just not sure. But from one person sending an email saying, I've had enough, I'm really angry about this, I don't like it, we've now got to this point where we're actually negotiating changes with our leadership team. And, you know, we've had other people that have resigned. I mean, there's been like a mass exodus of staff because it has been so bad, and the environment has been just getting worse and worse, and to the point where there's been people that haven't been on annual leave for 3 or 4 years and are just so burnt out they just need to go. And those people, instead of just leaving, have been having proper exit interviews. Like, even that is a small thing, like, or it might feel like a big thing, but it's one action of going and having an exit interview where you tell the truth and you say, this is the reality, this is why I'm leaving, and if this wasn't happening, I would still be a staff member on your books. And I went to one of the exit meetings with a staff member, and God, she was so brave. She read a poem to the executive director of the hospital, that the opening line was about small men who build cages for other people. And at the end of it, she said, so my question to you is, are you going to be a small man who builds cages for other people? And I was like, oh my word, this woman is so powerful.
Oh, Bonnie.
Yeah, far out. And we dismiss our anger and we shove it down. And if that first midwife had not done that and not sent, like had done that and not sent that email and not had enough and not thought, I'm going to put this into action, well, we'd still be in the same pile of poo that we were before. And we are still in the same pile of poo, but we're slowly trying to eke our way out of it. And it's a team effort. And I just think it's brilliant. And I think we all got to keep doing that, because you don't know what a tiny little action is going to add up to. And when I think about that film, you know, that film for the majority of it is made up of photos. So one photo plus another with tiny, tiny little movements in each different frame. And you add all those things together and you get a big, really long, fucking brilliant story. And that's what our lives are. Our lives are stories. And we can tell a story where we stayed quiet and we didn't say the truth and we didn't stick up for what we believed in. Or we can tell a story where we went on that heroine's journey and we said the thing and we made the call and we talked to the people and we did the right thing even though it stung. And how awesome if we all did that, because I reckon there'd be huge change in that.
Yeah, and to change the story of how unpowerful we all are, because, you know, that's often the story, isn't it, that we can't do anything, you know, as midwives in the system because it's so powerful. But actually, we all hold so much power. And if we come together even more, you know, there's that perfectly illustrates, you know, it just takes one person to step into their power and speak. And then if others come in behind, you know, there are more midwives than there are obstetricians or hospital managers. And they're the ones who are directly interacting with women.
Yeah, exactly. And I think, you know, we get into this hospital environment and all of a sudden we become these little small versions of ourselves that have to do the right thing and have to follow the policy. And
we don't. And often, because the system's so unused to us not doing it, that when you do buck the system, there's actually no response. Like, I can remember in Australia being expected to follow the policy of suctioning on the perineum with meconium, and I just said, I'm not doing it. Simple, not doing it. But you have to do it. Well, I'm not doing it. And I didn't do it. And then I brought in the research and put it on the table and said, if you want to know why I'm not doing it, there's the research, but I'm not doing it. And everyone just backed off. And there was like a bit of gossip and people going, oh my God, she doesn't do this thing. Now nobody does it because they've caught up. But it wasn't a huge impact. It was just, okay, well, Rachel's not doing that thing that we're meant to do.
And I think that's a thing. Like, you've also got to accept the fact that there's some people, and you're not going to be able to please everyone. And I know that there are some people in our unit who weren't happy that lady sent that email. And, you know, the reason they're not happy is because they think, oh, it's all a load of bullshit and it's not going to help anyway. Well, maybe it's not. I don't know. But give it a try. I mean, and that's the thing. One, like, little things add up. They really, really do. We had someone in our unit brought in a galaxy projector. So in our unit, we don't have any fairy lights, any candles, nothing. It's really hospitally. And someone brought in this little spaceman galaxy projector, and they were really embarrassed about bringing it in. It sort of sat in their car for weeks before they were brave enough to bring it in. And so they bring it in and they started using it for birds, and then someone else started using it as well. And now when I go into work, there's this big, like, I don't know, 20-litre tub, and it's full of candles and lights, and there's essential oils, and there's combs, and there's projectors, and there's speakers, and it's epic when we do something. And so I think, how many women out there have an idea and they're not doing it because they're a bit scared, or very scared, however scared you are. Maybe just do it. Or maybe just tell someone you want to do it.
And we are the culture. We kind of forget that. We've got all the cultures, this, the cultures, that's like, we are actually the culture. And you can change the culture through actions like that.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think, you know, with all the people, with everyone worrying about how big they are and how fat or thin we are, if we stop worrying about that and everybody was just the size that they were, like, I think it would take hundreds of years to change this culture, but maybe eventually it would become a thing where our bodies and the size they are the least interesting thing about us, which would be brilliant, because at the moment it's priority number one, which is exhausting.
Yeah, just think what you could do with all that energy focusing on something else other than, you know, the next diet or how to control your body.
Yeah, and all the stress that it puts in.
Yeah.
And
exactly.
pushes everything down, because you've got all of that consuming you. You can't have time or space to listen to those little creative ideas. And we are creative, and creativity can come as, I'm going to change an environment with a little light system that then becomes, actually, everybody who comes in now has the opportunity to come and use these candles or these lights, or, and that's creative voice. It's creative spirit. It has this kind of thread that then just ignites everybody else. And these, like, these tiny actions, we've talked about it before, it's like that cicada noise. One tiny, tiny little voice can be raised, but it takes the first step, and it's getting past all of that other noise and then being able to make it. And it can feel really scary, but I think sometimes the anger has to be utilized. Way that then is strength, then becomes hope for others. They get past their fear. They utilize the anger, not in a destructive way, but you utilize the anger in a way that is like, let's draw forces. We are strong. I have these ideas. I'm allowing for them to come out.
Yeah.
And even if it doesn't affect change, the power for you as an individual speaking your truth and saying that's wrong, I don't agree with that, even if it stays the same, at least you spoke up, at least you tried, at least you didn't go along with it, you didn't collude. Because the amount of, you know, anger and stress that we absorb when we go along with things that feel wrong, again, that's suppressing that little girl and her feelings, and it's so powerful to be able to, I mean, that, you know, most of the times I've spoken up, nothing has actually changed, but I have felt better. I've been able to go, I told you so. Likewise. If something happens, or I that's my favorite catchphrase, told you so. But yeah. I said that would happen. I pointed it out. I knew it would. I said my bit. If you didn't listen, that's not my problem. And then that's kind of released that anger in me. I can let it go because it's out.
Yeah.
And the other thing I think that women are really bad at, that just blocks our anger, is that boundary setting. The amount of resentment that women build up because they don't put the boundaries up, and they give all the bloody time, and they don't know how to say no, and they don't know how to center themselves. And we actually don't know how to support that with other women. You know, it's so interesting how many women how women respond to other women who just say, no, I'm not going to do that. Or I don't want to do that. Full stop.
And not giving a reason as well. Yeah. That's the other thing. I've learned that recently myself, is sometimes I don't, or I can't feel like I can't attend something, do something, whatever. And I would always in the past go, I'm really sorry, I can't because of X, Y, Z. Now I just say email, text, whatever form it is, whatever it is, I can't make that.
Yeah.
And no one comes back and says, why? No one. And I go, yes. What a release. I didn't actually need to do the sorry and just and those bloody words. I mean, the amount of stuff I've read about that over the last few years, it is so important. We are very much putting, I just wanted to see if you would look at this for me. I'm really sorry if, and I mean, I'm a classic over
the queen sorry
person. I'm Mrs. Sorry, exactly. And I'm learning. It drives Rachel insane and many others. However, that in itself, not giving a reason, however, just saying, I can't. It's a release.
If we're not doing everything that everybody asks us to do, and we're not saying yes to everything and people pleasing, then do we have a place in this world and are we allowed to exist? But the beauty of setting really firm boundaries and starting to say no to things is that I think there's a few things. So firstly, if I have somebody that I say no to, they know that they can say no to me. Like, and I usually say, mm-hmm. if it's the first time I'm saying no, I say, look, I'm actually practicing really conserving my energy. You know, I've got two little kids and I don't have a lot of energy at all. So I'm actually going to say no to this. Please, you know, you can invite me next time. And if it's the right time, I'll come, but I can't come this time. And it means they can say no to me next time. And they can know that I'm not going to get worried if they don't have a full reason or whatever. It doesn't matter. And the other beauty is that they're going to know then that when I do come to something that I've been asked to do or do something, it's because I really want to do it and I really want to be there. And I'm going to be there wholeheartedly, fully and completely. And it's actually beautiful because the things that you're invested in, you really invest in, you're never at something because you're just half, you feel like you have to do it. We've got to get out of that thing of we're doing it because we feel like we have to, because it's not genuine, like it's not us.
No, and then you just get resentful.
Yeah.
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 And guilt.
Yeah.
And which is anger.
Yeah, exactly. And it compounds into the whole thing of how much we expect, you know, women to do so much, keeping a home and raising kids and doing business projects and having, you know, success in XYZ area. No, we've got the limits of anyone. Like, we're not infinitely energetic. Everybody needs boundaries. And if we start setting boundaries and showing people, hey, I've reached my limit, then maybe they'll do that too. And maybe we'll all start acknowledging that we need to have wintering times. You know, we've got to have those times where we go and stock up on chocolate and then sleep for 3 months. It's just got to happen.
I had a year of no when I took a big huff years ago because I was completely burned out. I was in the middle of doing my PhD. And long story short, I was getting overloaded with stuff and I just went, right, for an entire year, my first response to anything is no. And I did. It was fantastic. So I'd have colleagues would open the door and go, I know you're going to say no, but, and then they'd ask me and then they'd go away and I'd think about it. And maybe in a few days time, I'd actually contact them and go, yeah, I will do that thing. But everything was no straight up.
Yeah.
I kind of wish I kept it going. Like, but yeah, maybe I should
sometimes
do that.
Sometimes it feels like you do to me, Rachel.
Well, I know. I do. Well, definitely. And that's part of my problem is when I do boundaries, like sometimes I can be a bit, What's the word, Katie? Harsh.
I'm saying absolutely nothing because I love you to pieces.
Like it is. I kind of don't finesse it. So I'm learning now that, like for Katie, I've said, I'll do this face to face because then I can do it in a way that's.
Don't not, put it in a text. Nope, I'm going to read it wrong.
Stop.
But I think there's also another part of the boundaries in terms of whether we're thinking of us as women and opening up to listen to ourselves, and that's a boundary of not comparing ourselves.
Mm.
Because I think that's also something about listening to your own intuition and being able to think about what's right for you, whether it's during the process of pregnancy, birth, labor, or as a midwife, or just being a woman in society, is that comes with that comparison, comes with so much stress and so much of the, you know, even if you're doing something on Instagram and you're watching other people who are around you, and then you think, oh, I might put this out. And then you think, how's that going to be received? Well, would they do that? And it's like, actually be your own voice. Because the thing is, if we were one homogenous midwife, one homogenous woman, lactation consultant, Christ, it would be so boring. That's the epitome of death, isn't it? This like, just keep doing everything the same and no change in life. And we have to go through all of these things. But I think if we're not, if we're constantly on this comparison and all the other things that we pile on top of us to make us small, where is the opportunity to ever get big, to ever come out, to ever have a voice, or to ever listen to our inner voice?
Yeah. And if you're always crowded with busyness and exhaustion and everything, that like it doesn't have space. It doesn't have anywhere to come out. And I think, you know, it's like I look at people like the people that we've got within midwifery that do their things. You know, is it Bashi Kumar Hazard who works on rights and advocation? And then you've got Hannah Darlin, who is, you know, really facing things head on and making changes where she can and speaking out. And then you've got the team that made Birth Time, and you've got, you know, we've got so many different people in this midwifery sphere that are doing the things that they do because they're good at them and they love them. And I wonder how many of those people said no to all that other stuff to get to that point where they knew what they wanted to do, what they were going to do. Because you can't do all this stuff saying yes to everything. It's not feasible. I think I've said no to everything that's been offered to me for about a year and a half because I've had nothing. And that film was the first thing I said yes to for a long, long, long time. And I don't think if I'd been saying yes to other things that I would have had a minute amount of capacity to do anything else, not a thing. And we've all got to slow down and just take a breath and go, it's okay if I am quiet today. It's okay if I don't go to that thing. And the people that love you and that are your true friends and that will stick through you through anything, you could say no to 10 things and they'll still be there and they'll catch up with you at the end, you know, like it's going to be okay. And you're going to get to know yourself even better. Yeah.
And you might lose some friends, but they're not real friends if they're not friends with you for who you really are. They're friends with you who you're trying to be in order to be liked.
And then you'll have more time. Win-win.
Yeah, this has been my year of slowing down, and slow and simple has been my mantra for this year. Slow and simple. Because just because you can do something like write another book doesn't mean that you should be doing it. And I'm just, you know, I'm having to learn that. I'm having to go, right, I'm going to have a year where I'm just doing the absolute bare minimum, saying no to pretty much everything so that I can actually see what it is that I want to grow. I'm kind of doing that on my property. I've just gone out and pulled a whole 10 years worth of weeds and overgrown vines and unearthed, you know, a mango tree I didn't know I had. And so I'm clearing my land to see what I've got, to see what I want to grow. And then I might plant something next year. But so that has been my year, is kind of weeding my life and weeding my property, because I just need that stop so I can see what I want to be doing and feel what I want to be doing. Because it's so easy to get caught up in the what you can do, what you're asked to do, and you lose yourself.
Mango tree, that's awesome.
Two mango trees, actually. just under a whole load of vines and overgrown saplings. And
yeah. But what a metaphor to round us up.
I know.
It's a perfect metaphor.
I would just like to say, though, that look at nature, because nature is actually like biomimicry. Yes. That's what we should be doing. They winter. They embrace wintering. Then they blossom. Like, it's really beautiful. It's really poetic, yep. And it's amazing. And also, in a forest, the older trees nurture the little saplings, yep. And help them to grow. It's wonderful.
Bonnie, it has been an absolute pleasure to have you on and speak and see you. And we will be putting up your video so that everybody can see. And I advise them to take tissues and watch it more than once, because it is something magical and powerful. Thank you so much for sharing it with all of us.
Thank you.
Thank you for having me. And thank you for letting me come and visit you in Switzerland and invite myself to your house. And
don't say that out loud, Bonnie. I'll be getting everyone wanting to come over.
Boundaries, Katie, boundaries.
Boundaries. I now say no. I'm going into my wintering. Right? Remember, it's winter for me now coming in Switzerland.
You're into your wintering. Yes, I'm going to assume Katie says no.
That's my new sign. Please don't press pause, but instead scroll on down on your podcast app. Yep, that's it, down there. And pop a review and maybe a few stars to make our eyes twinkle with glee. For more on breastfeeding and lactation content, head on over to my website where my course is. And for courses and books from Rachel, you can find everything in the links below. So all I gotta say now is, so here's the bloopers.
Rachel, you look about 30. Oh my gosh, you're so youthful.
What? Oh, like with the grey hair and stuff.
Grey hair means nothing, mate.
Sorry, I just got distracted.
It must be the camera must be shit on.
She waxes Vaseline on it every time.
Vaseline, right? I would get some.
Yeah, it's the Vaseline from the 20s. That's what she does on her lens. She's a right cheeky monkey.
It's probably just sweat, actually, from me doing that.
Yeah, nice. It works. Whatever you're doing, keep doing it, love.
That was a nice Aussie accent there, Katie.
That sounded posh.
Did posh it? Was it? Was it like Melbourne, like Prue and True?
Yeah, that.
Yeah,
going down to Fountain Gate.
Yeah, for the posh.
Park car.
But I love Kath and Kim. I really miss it. I wish there was more Kath and Kim on the regs.
Oh. But I used to watch it in England and like I thought it was hilarious. But then when I came here, it all suddenly made sense. And it was the first time I went to a plaza and they had a Bubs show. Like I thought they'd made that up, but there was actually a Bubs show.
And you told me to watch it, Rachel, before I got there. And then when I got to Melbourne and I started working in near Fern Gully something, that's where Fountain Gate is. Oh, it's the outskirts of Melbourne. And that was actually my local mall. And I was like, oh my God, my local mall is Fountain Gate. I couldn't say it any other way. Wondering which of my courses is for you? Breastfeeding and Lactation, the Fundamentals has been designed for everyone working in the birthing field or those on their journey to becoming breastfeeding specialists or IBCLCs. This course gives you 7 hours of CPD and is packed with reflective learning, case studies and some pretty tough, at times, quizzes to make sure this stuff sticks. It also means you can meet me monthly in my live Q&A. This is my course that I hope will fill in the gaps that traditional breastfeeding education has left out. I want you completing this, feeling confident to support any breastfeeding or lactation challenge of those in your care. But wait, I have another course called The Feeding Couch. Who's this for? Currently, around 80 to 96% of women decide to breastfeed during their pregnancy, but by just 8 weeks after birth, a third to almost 50% of those women have stopped breastfeeding. And of those women who stopped, 80% say they stopped breastfeeding before they wanted to. Learning about breastfeeding during pregnancy has been shown to improve breastfeeding self-confidence and improve the rate of exclusive breastfeeding in the short and the long term. I believe every mum should be able to choose how she wants to feed her baby and for how long. Knowledge is power. That's why I created the Feeding Couch, designed to be watched during pregnancy or for new mums and parents who may be struggling right now with breastfeeding. The content is in step-by-step, binge-worthy whilst pregnant or for those most tired of days postpartum, totally easy to find exactly what you need and dip in and out when you need a breastfeeding answer quickly. And for you, beautiful podcast listener, there is a 10% discount off both courses when you use the code POD10, that's P-O-D-10, at checkout. To find out more, hop on over to my website, katiejames.site, and have a look at the incredible content waiting for your lucky peepers.